Welcome to the 22nd episode of the Monthly Dirtcast. I'm Jared Dillian, editor and publisher of the Daily Dirt Nap, a financial newsletter for investment professionals. My guest today is Matt McGough. Matt has written for The Atlantic, The New York Times, The Los Angeles Times, and more. His acclaimed memoir, Bat Boy, Coming of Age with the New York Yankees, was the basis of Clubhouse, a primetime TV series on CBS, and his story about his first day with the Yankees was selected to lead the pilot episode of the Moth Radio Hour. Formerly a legal consultant and a writer for NBC's Law & Order, he lives in LA with his wife and two children. His new book, The Lazarus Files, a cold case investigation, will be published by Henry Holt in April 2019. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jared.
It's pretty cool that you sold TV rights to your book and they actually got picked up and made a show out of it. That's a little bit of a long shot, and it doesn't happen to very many people.
Yeah, it was a long shot upon a long shot, because getting a gig with the Yankees may have been an even longer shot. But yeah, I was pretty lucky when the book came out. It somehow made its hands to somebody at CBS in LA. And it didn't have a very long run, that show, Clubhouse. Maybe, I think, 10 episodes or so.
Yep.
But it's what got me out to California and, you know, led me eventually to Law & Order. So it was pretty fun. And strange, pretty surreal, too, to see these high school experiences get dramatized.
Yeah. Daily Dirt Nap folks, a lot of people don't know, I actually, you know, for my book Street Freak, I actually did sell TV rights. There was sort of a gold rush and all the financial books were being optioned for TV, and eventually Billions was kind of the first show to market, and everybody lost interest in the other ones after that, and so the rights have reverted to me, but you know, they did a good job with Billions. So hey,
yeah, yeah.
So what years were you Bat Boy for the Yankees?
1992 and 1993, which was, you know, my junior and senior years of high school.
Okay,
in New York.
So that was kind of, you know, the Yankees were improving, but it was still kind of the bad old days. It was the drought in between championships, between 81 and 96. What was the mood on the team at the time?
They were still the Yankees, you know. I mean, you know, the when I was a little bit younger, you know, I really kind of became a baseball fan in the mid-80s. So my favorite player as a boy was Don Mattingly. Remember watching, you know, Dave Winfield, Ricky Henderson, I can even remember seeing Reggie Jackson play at the stadium. But then, you know, the Mets were on top in 86. And then in the early 90s, the Yankees were kind of putting the pieces in place for the success they had later in the 90s. So Bernie Williams was there when I was there, Paul O'Neill, guys like that. Jeter was drafted. He wasn't on the team yet, but we're about the same age. So again, he was drafted out of high school, and I was a senior in high school, cleaning uniforms and shining cleats in the clubhouse. We were the same age. And then it was kind of the tail end of Mattingly's career. So it was a bit of a transition time, but, you know, the Yankee mystique was definitely palpable and something I was drawn to when I was a kid as a baseball fan.
So, you know, I've been a Yankee fan my whole life. The first baseball game I went to, my dad took me to a Yankees game in 1980, and it was a day game. It was the Yankees versus the Rangers, and Bobby Mercer hit a grand slam, and I was hooked pretty much for life. I was living on Governor's Island at the time.
Wow.
Yeah, my family was in the Coast Guard, so. It was a Coast Guard base. I was living on Governor's Island, and we went to a fair amount of Yankees games. I turned into a big Yankee fan. I was 5, 6, 7 years old at the time, and then I moved to Connecticut, the eastern part of Connecticut, in sort of in Red Sox territory, and I grew up as a Yankees fan in the middle of Red Sox territory. But Dave Winfield was my favorite player, and I think I liked Dave Winfield as a kid because he has the best swings and misses in the history of the game.
Yeah, he would take some hacks. He was awesome. I remember watching him, you know, play the field too, go over the fence and pull back some home runs at least once live when I was a kid. That was pretty thrilling.
Yeah, it
was. But yeah, he was awesome.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear you say Paul O'Neill. You know, Paul was one of my favorite players during that championship run, and now I get to hear him pretty much every night on Yes, and I think he's hilarious. I think he's one of the funniest broadcasters in the game, hugely entertaining, and I'm just happy to hear him every night.
Yeah, he, you know, it's funny, different guys' personalities. He was super intense. I mean, a really nice guy. But I don't know that I would have pegged him as a broadcaster later in his career, because
yeah,
he wasn't one of the most talkative guys. You know, he just had that quiet intensity and then that explosive intensity when he'd strike out with the bases loaded or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's got a pretty great second career going.
So I looked up some of the other players on the roster. So you mentioned Bernie Williams, you mentioned Paul O'Neill. Wade Boggs was on that team.
93. Charlie Hayes was the third baseman in my first year, but then Wade Boggs came in 93.
Yep.
My second year.
Jim Abbott, who most people remember through the no-hitter. Of course, Jim Leyritz. And the one I wanted to talk to you about was, did you know Kevin Moss?
Yes.
Because he had a very interesting career. He came up in 1990 and 1991, he put together these monster years. And then by 1993, his career was pretty much over. Do you know what happened?
I think there's lots of guys through baseball history who, you know, get off to sensational starts and then it's really hard to sustain. I don't know whether it's the pitchers see them a couple times around, or it's just tough to make adjustments, I think, on the major league level. So he flamed out pretty quickly, but I remember him pretty well. He was a really nice guy. Really bright guy. I think he may have gone to like UC Berkeley or somewhere for college.
Mm-hmm.
Not 100% sure, but yeah, he was a really nice guy. I remember him pretty fondly. But yeah, I was there for his heyday.
Yep.
Or maybe, you know, not 90-91 when I think he hit 20 homers as a rookie, quite possibly.
Yeah. Yep.
But, yeah, he was, you know, sharing time at first base, backing Mattingly up, and DHing.
Yep. So tell us how you got the bat boy job. Now, I know this is a really amazing story, and I've heard the story, and we don't have time for the whole story, but I'd like to just, you know, it's super motivational too. Just tell us how you got the job.
Yeah, I was really lucky, and the more time that passes, kind of the more of a miracle it seems that it actually worked out. But when I was a sophomore in high school, I went to high school in the city, so would go up to games sometimes with friends after school. And it was in the fall of 91, I was in the bleachers, and I noticed that there was a kid on the field sitting on a stool down the first baseline. And I knew that bat boys existed, but I'd never really noticed them before, you know, during the game. This kid was playing catch with Jesse Barfield, the right fielder. And after the game, I went home and just kind of on a lark. I was 15 or 16 years old, but I decided to write a letter to the Yankees asking whether, you know, I could apply to be a bat boy. And it was a pretty earnest letter I wrote. And I remember I sent copies to you know, pretty much anybody. I tore the page out of the program that listed all the front office executives. And I think everybody from Steinbrenner, so Gene Michael, who was the GM, and Stump Merrill, who was the manager, I think they all got a letter. And nothing really happened. And I was so naive, I thought, oh, well, they must not have gotten my letter. I thought that's what the issue was. So I picked up the phone, called the Yankees again. And a couple days after that, you know, I got a letter inviting me to come in for an interview, and went in for the interview and was told come back opening day. So that's pretty much how it happened. And it wasn't until opening day when I walked in that I really, you know, believed that it was really going to happen. So it sort of changed my life.
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of life lessons. I feel very much the same way about me getting a job at Lehman. I was such a massive underdog. I think you mentioned to me that all the other Bat Boys became Bat Boys because they had connections to Yankees employees in some way. And
necessarily kind of Silver Spoon type connections, like, you know, season ticket holders, sons, or anything like that. It was more, you know, people who were connected to the clubhouse. So like the guy who catered the post game spread. It was like an Italian restaurant in the Bronx. Like, his nephew was one of the guys who I worked with. Yeah. Or, you know, friends of other Bat Boys, younger brothers who end up getting hired. I was the only kid in memory to have written a letter and somehow get my way in the door.
Huge long shot. So yeah. Being a Bat Boy, I think if you watch what the Bat Boys do on TV, it doesn't seem like a lot of work. But it is a lot of work, right? Like, what kind of stuff do you do?
Yeah, it was long hours, especially considering, you know, we were in high school, or I was in high school at the time. So we'd have to, you know, there's obviously what you see during the game. There's, you know, usually two kids in the dugout and one down the line, and the same thing in the other dugout. But we actually had to get there 4 or 5 hours before first pitch. And you'd really would help you do everything to keep the clubhouse running. So everything from laundry to cleaning shoes, you know, putting the food out for the post-game spread, cleaning up afterwards, vacuuming the clubhouse, emptying the trash, you know, whatever needed to be done. And then, you know, after the game, there'd be a lot of work to do too in terms of emptying the dugout, getting stuff ready for the next day. Like I said, the laundry, the shoes. So it was not uncommon for like a 7 p.m. night game, even on a weeknight, a school night, to, you know, be up at the stadium 3:30, and then by the time we'd finish at night, the game would end at 10. It was not uncommon for it to be midnight, even 1 o'clock in the morning, by the time we finished our work, and then to have to go to school the next day.
And what did you get paid? I mean, you would have done it for
salary,
free.
Maybe it was a daily salary. I think it was like $35 a game my memory.
So about
which, again, I'm not complaining because I wasn't doing it for the money, obviously. But, you know, you didn't. It was pretty much right around minimum wage, I would think, for the amount of time that we spent there.
Yeah.
But I would have done it for free.
Yeah, pretty much everyone would. That's very cool.
Yeah.
So you were 16, 17 years old and, you know, just a kid. And you're in this clubhouse full of grown men with whatever extracurricular activities they had going on in their lives. You know, what guys in their 20s and 30s talk about. Like, you don't have to get into specifics, but, like, it must have, like, blown your head off to, you know, be fraternizing with these guys on a daily basis.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest lessons for me that I understood, you know, pretty quickly over time as I got to, you know, as I kind of grew comfortable in the scene was just, I'd never really thought about these athletes who I'd idolized as, you know, real people. I mean, it sounds kind of crazy, but you kind of grow up thinking of them as kind of superheroes or two-dimensional figures, you know? I mean, somebody strikes out and you boo like crazy, or you don't think that they have feelings or other things going on in their lives or pressures or but yeah, it was kind of an education in human nature, because it was a very diverse group of guys, and you're right, they were older than me, and you know, there's a pretty big difference between, you know, being 16 or 17, going to school, living at my parents' house, and then, you know, these guys who were, you know, in their early 20s and up, some of them married, had families. I mean, it was only like 7 or 8 years or less of age difference, but it felt like more. But then at the same time, they made me feel like I was part of the team. So I did feel like I was one of the guys with them. And there were a handful of guys on the team who really were just fantastic in terms of, you know, making me feel just welcomed and part of the team.
It's funny you mention, you know, about like these guys having feelings and getting booed and stuff like that. Like, I think, you know, it's sort of, a lot of the booing gets done on social media these days, but anybody who's a public figure, I mean, I think the terminology is different these days. Like, people talk about having haters or whatever, but I think people lose sight of the fact that people that you know, see on TV or on the internet or whatever are just, they're real people and they have feelings, you know?
Yeah. I kind of stopped booing at sports events after working for the Yankees. Yeah. I just don't do it, you know, maybe just kind of a switch flipped or something like that. 'Cause yeah, I mean, it's hard. Like, you're in front of, it's like, there's no hiding when you're out on the field, you know?
Yeah.
And I can also remember there were some really great guys who I just really liked and respected who struggled on the field. I remember there was a pitcher named Tim Leary.
Mm-hmm.
Who I'd have to go back and look at his stats, but he had a pretty rough year or two with the Yankees, and would just hear the boo birds every time he took the field. And he eventually was traded, and I can just so remember the day that he was traded, because I just thought, I just wanted him to pitch so well and be successful, because he was just the nicest guy. He had a great sense of humor. You know, starting pitchers, they're out there once every 5 days. So 4 out of every 5 days, he'd be sitting on the bench just shooting the breeze. And I just really liked him personally. So it was traumatic when he was, I don't even remember where he was traded to, but it was like, I remember shaking his hand and wishing him luck or something, that, again, was like probably pretty earnest for a kid to, you know, Tim, good luck on your, you know, with your new team kind of thing. But yeah, it was the personalities of the players and getting to know them as people that was really kind of mind blowing.
So we talked before we got on, and I think you mentioned to me that the biggest difference between baseball today and baseball 25 years ago is the presence of social media and how that is changing things. And some people have used it to their benefit, you know, Didi Gregorius with his emojis and stuff like that. And some players are proficient with it. But, you know, there's been some ball players that have had some old tweets come up that are, you know, off color or bad. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that, I think the experience would have been, I mean, there's many, many things that are different today than when I was there. And I think things have to just be a lot tighter now, I would imagine, in terms of you know, I didn't have a social media account. The ball players didn't have social media accounts. There was a lot of interaction with fans, but it was all offline,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It was like from the field to the stands or that kind of thing. So it's different. It's definitely different. And, you know, I think people are realizing that, you know, if you post stuff that is offensive or insulting or racist or sexist or whatever it may be, you know, it doesn't go away. And, you know, there's a price to pay for that when it surfaces, as several guys have learned this year.
Yeah. Do you feel like the players, when they go home, they feel as anonymous today as they did back then?
It's interesting. You think they feel anonymous today?
No, I
think not every guy. But like, I mean, like, it's hard for Aaron Judge to be anonymous.
No,
right?
I know. I think, I mean, there's, you know, probably half
guys in the bullpen and stuff. Probably.
Yeah. It probably depends on who you are, but it seems that with the level of scrutiny and media attention on athletes, not just baseball but any sport, that it's kind of difficult to walk around town and, you know, not only not get recognized, but you can't misbehave either, you know.
Yeah, they live in a fishbowl for sure. You know, one of the interesting things I can remember, I mean, at the time that I was working there in the early 90s, and part of this may just be you know, how New York City has changed and gentrified over the years. But at the time that I was a Bat Boy, I think probably like 90 to 95% of the Yankees lived in Jersey or Westchester.
Mm-hmm.
And so we weren't really out in the city, you know? I mean, I was going to school in the city and moving around the city, but it seemed like the players were leading.
So they were commuters, basically.
Suburban lives,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But then that, I think, changed. I think Jeter was one of the guys who started to change that in the 90s. And I think now, I would guess, some of them probably still live in the suburbs. But more and more guys lived in Manhattan. Which is interesting, and I think, you know, for guys like Jeter, they're in the fishbowl, but they embrace that to a degree, you know?
Yeah.
They didn't want to live out in the boonies. They wanted to be where the action was.
Yeah. So you were involved in baseball. And the other big change to baseball over the last 25 years is sabermetrics and statistics, and, you know, you were there pre-Moneyball. I lived in the East Bay in the late 90s when Billy Beane was putting that team together, the Moneyball team. So I'm super familiar with what happened out there and read the book and all that stuff. Were you close enough to Buck Showalter? And, you know, did you have any inkling as to how the team was being managed qualitatively, quantitatively? You know, can you speak to that at all?
I remember, Buck Showalter became manager, I'm pretty sure, in 92, which was my first year. So I guess we both started at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to look at his managerial stats, but I think his first year with the Yankees was 92, and he was a pretty young guy. He had played in the minors. He may have even been a teammate in the minors of some of the guys who were on the Yankees roster. And he was, I remember, just very intense. He was, you know, he wasn't the type to share the scouting reports with the Bat Boys and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember him. You know, we would, the clubhouse guys, me and the other Bat Boys, we would often spend the night at Yankee Stadium if we had a night game, like on a Friday night, and then a day game the next day, just because of the hours and stuff. It wouldn't be worth it to go home for a couple of hours. So we would just grab a blanket and sleep on the couches in the players' lounge. And I can remember Showalter also staying overnight, sleeping in his office, doing things like watching video. That at that time, it was like getting a videotape and sticking it in a VCR in his office. Now, I think it's one of the biggest changes, like digital video and the amount of, these guys can pull up every at bat on their iPad. Pitchers can go through the lineup that they're going to face. There's just so much more technology at the player's disposal today, whereas when I was there, it was pretty analog.
Yeah.
But I do remember Showalter watching video in his office and keeping really pretty intense hours. You know, he was pretty driven.
Well, he has a reputation as a very smart manager, you know.
Yeah, he's very cerebral.
Yeah.
He's very cerebral, and he would put in the hours.
It's too bad.
So he wouldn't pal around with the clubhouse guys so much, but I respected him. Again, it's like things unfolded the way they did with Joe Torre coming in, and Buck has gone on to a, you know, pretty solid career, with several teams. But you know, he probably would have had a ring or two with the Yankees if they had, had kept him around, just because the pieces were in place while he was there.
Yeah.
And then Torre brought it home.
One question, and then we'll go to the break. One thing I've always been curious about, you know, you have this team of 25 guys, and, you know, there's different personalities. They're all different guys, and some are great friends, and some may not like each other. You know, the challenge is, how do you get everybody going in the same direction? You have 25 completely different individuals. When people watch baseball on TV, you know, say Aaron Judge hits a home run, rounds the bases, come in the dugout, and he gets a bunch of high fives, but you don't see somebody who doesn't give him a high five. Talk about some of the personalities or personality conflicts that were present on that team, and whether in you know, maybe if that continues today.
Yeah, famously in like the late 70s and the early 80s, when it was the Bronx Zoo days with Reggie Jackson and Billy Martin and Catfish Hunter, and like, I think those guys would they had some pretty legendary blowouts and tensions that boiled over privately and publicly. It was never really that bad when I was there, you know, and I would probably credit Mattingly, who was the captain, obviously, but Donnie's personality was just so consistent and so down to earth, and he was the same every single day, and he treated everybody respectfully, teammates, front office, bat boys, you know, grounds crew. It seemed like, you know, he saw everybody. People who were kind of invisible, you know what I mean? Like, kind of how the bat boys were invisible to me until I noticed them, even though they were there. There was nothing that, like, Don Mattingly had to, you know, learn each bat boy's name, or knew that, you know, one of the grounds crew guys had just gotten married, or, you know, he that was his personality. And it seemed to me like everybody respected him. And so it's just kind of the example he set in terms of everybody pulling in the same direction and kind of how to approach the daily grind, because the baseball season is a grind. So I would credit his leadership for kind of setting the tone.
Yeah.
And then in terms of, you know, personality conflicts, the one that I can remember the most was probably Bernie Williams and Mel Hall, who was, you know, the Yankee.
Yeah,
Bernie
I remember
was.
I remember Mel Hall.
Yeah,
for sure.
He was the rookie center fielder, and Mel Hall was kind of a more veteran right fielder. And Mel just had a, I guess, acerbic personality would be kind of a fair way to say it. He would stir things up, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think he's ended up in trouble. I'm pretty sure he's in prison now. Your listeners can Google for the details of that case. Mm-hmm. But he was kind of harsh on Bernie when he came up. And I think it became public to a degree, like it was written about.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of teasing him. Bernie is a quiet personality. He's an extremely talented musician. I mean, he plays the guitar.
Yep.
I think now he like tours and performs. He's that good. But yeah. He had like a kind of an artistic personality for an athlete. It was unusual, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And quiet. He wore glasses. I mean, he was just a sensitive kid. And he was, you know, he was young. He was in his early 20s. And I can remember Mel, he just kind of had a target on his back with Mel. Mm. And I can remember kind of seeing some of that. And, you know, Bernie's extremely talented. He was a mainstay on those teams later in the decade. And I think the team recognized that. And it was Mel who got shipped out within a year or two.
Yeah.
But that was probably, you know, that's the one that sticks out of my head from that time. But Mattingly kept things on a level. And I just think nobody wanted to disappoint Mattingly, you know? I mean, it was like he wouldn't, you know, scold you if you were doing if you saw somebody doing something not the right way. But just like disapproval from him would have just been like devastating. I felt like the way he treated people, it's like he respected me, and so I wanted to do my best. I wanted to show him that same respect.
Yeah. Well, he's got his hands full with the Marlins right now.
Yeah, he does.
Yep.
He does. But I just have nothing but good things to say about him. And I hope he, you know, I like Aaron Boone. You know, hopefully the Yankees go far in the playoffs this year and Aaron Boone successful as a manager. But I hope one day Donnie Baseball comes back to the Bronx. I think that would be great. That and he'll great. Have had
yeah.
a lot of, you know, he's managed now in LA, which was one kind of team, big money, big market. And now he's in Miami, a bit out of the spotlight.
You know, he's outperformed expectations in Miami. I mean, you know, they've, you know, I don't know how many wins they have. They have a lot more than Baltimore. They're not the worst team in baseball, which was everybody's prediction at the beginning of the season.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not in that clubhouse, so I can't speak directly to the relationships between him and the players, but I would imagine it's the same kind of thing. Like you want to do your best for him, you know?
Yeah.
And the fact that he had the playing career that he's had, it just gives him a certain authority in terms of, you know, working with young players. They have like a really incredibly young team that has, you know, not accomplished much, and so he, you know, has to kind of build confidence. And I think again, I bet his MO is just that grind, the daily approach, and you know, getting guys to young guys to play above their heads. And so yeah, I would love nothing more. I just hope it's just a matter of time till he gets his World Series ring as a manager.
Cool. Let's take a quick break. I just want to let you guys know, if you're interested in reading my stuff, a good starting point is the 10th Man newsletter published by Malden Economics, and it's absolutely free. Free isn't free as in it doesn't cost anything. The name of the newsletter actually comes from World War Z, if you ever saw that. To sign up, all you have to do is go to www.10thman.us. That's www.10thman.us. That's 10th as in number 10. It's a good introduction to how I think about markets, and there's plenty of funny stuff in there too. Just go to www.10thman.us. How old were you when you wrote the book?
Let's see, it was 2005 it came out, so I was 30.
So that's actually not the easiest thing to do. I mean, to sit on those memories for 14 years. It must have made such an impression on you. Those memories must have been so vivid that you could write about that 14 years later.
Yeah, it really was vivid. And, you know, I'd always wanted to be a writer. I always loved reading when I was a kid and loved books. And as a teenager, I really became a reader by reading books about baseball. Pretty much any, you know, Mickey Mantle's A Biography of Mantle, or books about like the Bronx Zoo and the craziness of the Yankees in the 70s and 80s, and David Halberstam's book, Summer of 49. Like, I just devoured those books when I was a kid. And then that's was part of being a baseball fan. And then I was inside the clubhouse for 2 years and did have all these amazing experiences. And when I would tell people about them, you know, while I was working there and then, you know, during college and after, people would say, wow, those are just incredible stories. You should really write a book. But I think it took a while to kind of get the courage to actually attempt it. And I think it was probably for the best, because it just gave me a little more life experience and perspective on what it was like. And it certainly was, the book came out differently, given that I was writing it in my late 20s than if I had sat down right afterwards at 18 and if I had kept a diary the whole time and published that, it probably would have been more juvenile and less, reflective about some of the same questions you asked about, you know, guys' personalities and putting yourself in different people's shoes and things like that. So it all worked out as it should have, in terms of waiting a little while before putting pen to paper.
Did you ever think about being a baseball writer?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I still love baseball. I love sports in general. It's great stuff to write about, and the personalities and, the tension. Being a beat writer, I think would be pretty hard. You know, I mean, I got to see those guys work up close too every day, and got to see the interactions between them and the ball players. I think it'd be fun. I don't know whether it's going to happen for me.
I think it would be hard too.
Job as a beat writer covering the Yankees or another team. But yeah, at a certain point, that was certainly something that I considered and thought would be fun.
So Law and Order, you tell us about your experience there. How did you get hooked up with it? You wrote for 4 seasons. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, so I think I was hired by Law & Order in 2006, so it ended up being the last 4 seasons of the show. It was the main, they called it the mothership, so Law & Order, you know, period, not Special Victims Unit or Criminal Intent.
Right.
It was the original one that I was hired to work on. And after college, I had gone to law school, so I had a law degree. And then I wrote the Yankees book. And then after the clubhouse, the Yankees, you know, the TV show based on my book came and went, I was looking for what to do next and found out that Law and Order's legal consultant had left for some other writing gig and that they were looking for a replacement. So threw my hat in the ring and was hired initially as the legal consultant for the show. So it was more advising the writers than actually writing episodes myself, but that was the best possible preparation for screenwriting because I was just reading scripts. And for any of your listeners who are interested in screenwriting or pursuing a career in Hollywood or as a sideline or anything, you know, the best thing you can possibly do to learn how to write screenplays is read screenplays, mm-hmm. other people's screenplays, things that have been made. And so there were 23 episodes a season. So, you know, I read 23 scripts that first year, men and women who had been doing it for a while and very successful. And then within a year or two, I was promoted from legal consultant to staff writer. So I think that was my title for the last two seasons. So I ended up getting to write and co-write several episodes, which was a lot of fun and a thrill because it was a show that I had grown up watching. And I, you know, even though I've lived in LA now for the last several years, you know, I'm still a New Yorker at heart.
Yeah.
So it was exciting to be able to write about my city and write about cops and prosecutors and tell dramatic stories, you know, ripped from the headlines. I was sorry when the show was canceled. I you know, part of me wishes it had kept going.
Yeah. Well, my wife watches all the reruns.
Yeah, they're still on.
Yeah, she does.
Yeah.
It's a dark show. It's a depressing show. I need more uplifting stuff.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah. So usually what I do in my podcasts is I have a speed round where we go through a bunch of like funny questions. We're almost out of time. I'm going to give you two speed round questions that pertain directly to our talk today. And the first one is, who is the best Law and Order district attorney?
Probably Sam Waterston.
You think so?
Yeah, I would say so. He had, like, by the time I came onto the show, I'm pretty sure he got promoted. He was like, I think he was the actual district attorney as opposed to, the assistant district attorney who actually is making the arguments in the courtroom. But yeah, he's a great actor and kind of an iconic character in the universe of the show. So I probably put him at the top of the list, but you know, it was an ensemble show and it was successful. So they had good actors, you know, across the board. He was one of several.
Yeah. My personal favorite was Fred Thompson, the late Fred Thompson. I liked him a lot in that role.
Yeah. I remember being on some conference calls with Senator Thompson.
Yeah.
My first year with Law and Order. And then I think he moved on, and I think Jack McCoy, Sam Waterston, was promoted to take his place. So you have a good memory.
Yep. Yep. And the other question is, how old is Gary Sanchez?
That's a good question. Is that is that in dispute? I don't know that I've read very much about that. I know other ball players, you know, their birth certificates resurface and it turns out they're actually, you know, 35 and not 28 or something like that.
I don't think
I know El Duque, there were some questions.
Yeah. He was like 50. I don't think there's any Gary Sanchez truthers out there. All I'm saying is the guy looks like he's in his late 30s. He looks old. And
Yeah. Well, catching puts years on anything, I would imagine. And I don't care how old El Duque is. I loved watching that guy pitch, and he was so clutch in the playoffs. I don't care if he was 70 years old in a, you know, passing for 30. Give that guy the ball with the game on the line.
Absolutely. Him and Andy Pettit. Andy Pettit, too. Yep.
Yeah, they were awesome. Yep. They were, it was exciting to watch, even though my time with the Yankees had ended by that point. Those were really likable teams I had in,
you know, I so
late 90s, because they were all homegrown. It was all from the inside, you know?
You know, I mentioned I started watching the Yankees in 80, 81, and, you know, I went 15 years without a World Series. And when they won in 96, I was actually in the Coast Guard, and I was out to sea, and I could not watch any of it.
It's brutal.
That was brutal. It was brutal. Missed the whole thing. Anyway, thanks for coming on, Matt. Please tell us where we can find you online. Where can we look you up?
Yeah, I have an author website, MatthewMcGough.com, and I'm on Twitter, and I have a new book coming out next April, which is a nonfiction book about a cold case murder in Los Angeles that I've been researching for the last several years. And that book is called The Lazarus Files, A Cold Case Investigation, and it'll be published by Henry Holt. Next April 2019. So looking forward to that piece of work getting out there.
Yep. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you, Jared. Thanks for having me on.
This concludes the 22nd episode of the Monthly Dirtcast. Thanks to our guest, Matt McGough. Thanks to Blake Gerald for letting me use his track, Punta del Este. And if you want to learn more about the Daily Dirt Nap, go to www.dailydirtnap.com. That's www.dailydirtnap.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Daily Dirt Nap. Until next time, so long.